at this conference. Now, because this is the last talk of the meeting, I thought I should have about perspectives which I have developed, perspectives for the asymptotic safety scenario. Now, the motivate for this, does it work? The motivation, obviously, for many of us, in order to look into the conceptual setup of asymptotic safety, is the standard model of particle physics, because it's such an extraordinarily successful setup based on local quantum field theory, describing three out of the four fundamental interactions which we know experimentally. Theory of strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions. Those which have been very successfully probed up to energy scales of roughly 100 GeV. And in particular, the LHC, which hopefully will switch on shortly, will clarify all the interesting and more subtle aspects of the electric sector of the standard model. Now, obviously, the question is, what about gravity in this type of setup? Presently, we do not have a fully satisfactory understanding of all fundamental forces, and in particular, not for gravity, which, so it seems, introduces a completely different energy scale, the Planck scale, which, with present day's experimental technologies, unfortunately is not accessible. Furthermore, as has been highlighted already at this meeting, the perturbative quantization procedure, so the aim to understand gravity on the same footing as the other forces, still seems to be facing problems. So the question is, what to do about this? Now, an important observation which has been made very, very early on, Wilson, is that if you'd like to understand the high energy behavior of local quantum field theories, perhaps the most appropriate notion for doing so is the notion of a high energy fixed point. And it is particular this type of notion, which is underlying one of the most successful local quantum field theories we know, which is Young-Wills theory, or QCD. Now, in QCD, we know experimentally how the running coupling looks, right? Okay, so this is a plot from the particle data group, right? That shows the running of the Young-Mills, the QCD coupling constant. And we also know on theoretical grounds how this coupling, the running of this coupling looks like in the context with here four massless part flavors. Okay? So the most distinctive feature of this is that this theory displays a non-trivial high-energy fixed point in the ultraviolet. So the fact that the renormalization group teaches us this theory wants to be essentially weakly coupled at high energies allows for a systematic and reliable interpretive quantization of this type of theory. Now, this observation underlies the proposal made by Weinberg about 30 years ago that possibly the fact that all the nice theories such as QCD are weakly coupled at high energies, perhaps this feature is not what is absolutely essential in order to make this, to transform that into a predictive formalism based within quantum field theory. Perhaps it's already sufficient to know that the theory does display a non-trivial high energy fixed point. Because as long as we have this fixed point, the renormalization group flow of the corresponding theory will find that fixed point as a high energy anchor to fix or to determine its high energy scaling in a well-defined way without running into inconsistencies or singularities along the renormalization group trajectory. Now, this is an idea which obviously has sparked a lot of interest and is kind of not very far away from the original notions of the perturbatively quantizable theory. All of this, to some extent, I mean, maybe I should flesh out these few points because they have been discussed already at this meeting in great detail, namely the question of what you actually would need, in addition to having a fixed point, which is like the statement that you do need a finite dimensional ultraviolet critical surface, which is equivalent to saying that the number of parameters which you have to tune in order to be able to reach that fixed point should be finite, or else predictive power would potentially be spoiled. Now, let's have a slightly more detailed look into what RG scaling within, or the gravitational coupling within this type of setup would mean and actually imply. Thank you. Okay, so to that end, I've written down a renormalization group equation for the gravitational coupling. So the gravitational coupling, the dimension for gravitational coupling as it would appear in a gravitational action, say, is Gn, has mass dimension 2 minus d. So to prepare for a renormalization group treatment, I make this coupling dimensionless, and I multiply it with the appropriate power of, say, my renormalization group scale mu. So this will be, by construction, a dimensionless coupling. Now, if I may imagine of switching on, say, some Kalman-Simancic type running, this coupling will acquire a non-trivial wave function renormalization group factor. It is this factor which, along a renormalization group trajectory, will carry all the non-trivial relevant physics. And it is this factor which tells us, is there something interesting going on or not? Now, in standard field theory, say, parametrizations, people are used to introduce, say, rather anomalous dimensions. So let me do the same here. The anomalous dimension associated to this wave function renormalization factor is just its logarithmic derivative with respect to scale parameter mu. So with this at hand, one can immediately write down, although only formally, the renormalization group equation for this type, for this dimensionless gravitational coupling. And it is given by an equation, namely, it is an equation which tells you there is a term originating from the canonical dimension of the gravitational coupling. So this term just reminds us of the fact that the underlying coupling constant indeed carries a mass dimension. There is a second term here coming into play because the running of the coupling will acquire a non-trivial wave function renormalization correction. So this term expressed as an anomalous dimension will appear here, and all of that multiplied by G. So in a way, not much has happened until now, because I have not even told you how actually I would like to compute or get access to this non-trivial piece of information. Okay, so this is just a structural argument.
Yeah. Are you keeping Gn fixed in this problem?
Yes, obviously. Gn is a number which is fixed once and for all. So if, I mean, you may think of having some renormalization condition at some reference scale mu zero where you fix this number. Okay. Good. So all the non-trivial bits and pieces of information about what is actually going on in this theory and how interactions of all possible higher order invariants in your theory, such as curvature invariants, how meta fields may couple into this theory, all this information is, for the time being, hidden in the anomalous dimension eta n. Okay. Now, just from this structure, you can now do nothing. I can go back. Except either. Yes, this is a fixed point of my talk. Fortunately, it's the right transparency. Okay. Let me see.
But this is an infrared fixed point.
Well, we are sitting on it, but if you're sitting on it, you don't know. Okay, so let's see. Okay, here we are again. So, I said that structurally speaking, we get this type of equation. Now, now you may ask, good, let's see, if we want to buy Weinberg's idea, what would that imply in the setup? So you ask, if we have a fixed point to this equation, what would be its implications without even knowing explicitly of how these anomalous dimensions actually look? And you immediately detect two types of qualitatively different fixed points. Now, the first one is G equals zero. Now, that's in a way something reasonably trivial, but you see, this is what one would be tempted to interpret as the Gaussian fixed point of this theory, because it's in its vicinity, corrections coming into play because of quantum fluctuations, so proportional to the anomalous dimension of the field, are very small. So that means that the corresponding dimensionful coupling, Gn, or the running dimensionful coupling, which is Gn times this wave function renormalization, essentially don't change. The coupling remains constant. That's what we would call classical general relativity. Now, there's another regime, or possibly more of them, where this beta function displaces zero implicitly, which is at the point where the anomalous dimension gets large and actually precisely counterbalances the canonical dimension of the coupling. Now, if this is going to happen, you suspect that strong quantum effects indeed did modify the scaling behavior of your theory, yes, and the behavior is likely to be of a non-Gaussian nature related to non-trivial gravitational interactions. Now, if you retranslate what I just said in terms of the running coupling constant, I mean the dimensionful one, the coupling which does appear in the underlying action, okay, it would mean that in its high energy limit, nu going to infinity, the coupling scales like some numerical value fixed by the fixed point of the theory, okay, multiplied by the energy scale to the power 2 minus d. So automatically, you would find a kind of dimensional suppression of the gravitational interaction strength. So it would seem as if gravity becomes very weak, but at the same time, the theory is non-trivial because underlying to this is a non-trivial gravitational fixed point. Okay, so far so good. So obviously the question is there any truth in this? And if so, what are the means to possibly access it and to ask explicit questions? Does gravity behave this way? Okay. And one of the techniques which has been discussed a lot at this conference, and I will go into a little bit deeper into its technicalities, well, at least say a few words to it, are renormalization group techniques a la Wilson. Now, if I say Wilson, what I have in mind is the idea of, I mean, intuitively trying to formulate a path integral representation for a theory and then successively integrate out momentum modes in that path integral, if I so can. Now, in the standard way, meaning not talking about gravity, okay, this is a reasonably straightforward procedure and has been very successfully so implemented for many scalar theories. So where you would formally start with a microscopic action and little by little integrate out momentum phase so that a renormalization group flow for your effective action, starting up here, integrating out modes, would bring you down to the physical effective action. Now, in gravity, unfortunately, we have to face the opposite problem. In gravity, we are faced with the situation that we seem to know what effectively the low energy theory is, because the low energy limit of that theory is that, in essence, should be classical general relativity. So, as opposed to what one would like to do in QCD, where one has an understanding of what the microscopic interactions is, and we'd like to integrate our momentum modes to learn something about, say, bound states in QCD, in gravity, we have to face the opposite problem, because we kind of know what the low energy limit is, but the speculation right now in this game is that up here, potentially there could be a non-trivial object, which I baptized gamma star, so to refer to some type of fixed point action, which could be used as an input and applied as an input microscopic fixed point effective action, which, if I would be starting it with solid integrating out of there, it would lead me precisely to the well-known infrared classical general relativity type physics we know experimentally. So that's a kind of physical idea we'd like to try to implement in some way. And I'd like to formalize that a little bit. In order to do that, I will give you an equation which you all know, which is a textbook equation about an exact functional differential equation, okay, which tells you how an effective action, now gamma k, evolves if I throw something like a mass term into the theory. So this is the well-known Kalman-Simonsky equation, which you may or may not have seen in this form, but it's nothing else but that. So it's in the Kalman-Simonsky equation, where in this functional form, actually it's given in the paper by Simonsky. It's just the question of how a theory would react if I throw a mass term into it. Okay. Kalman-Simonsky equation, which tells you how the effective action changes, so k d over dk, right, if I throw just a mass term into the theory, you can ask the theory, tell me, yes, what will you do? Now there's this tiny little label, rem, on that equation, which reminds you of the fact that actually this flow equation, so the Kalman-Simonsky equation itself, does require an additional regularization, because this operator trace here is ill-defined at large momenta, so you have to implement some regularization. I mean, this is all well understood, and people have studied these type of things in the past. Now, I've given you this equation because I think, I mean, this equation is very well known, and I mean, perhaps you can appreciate a bit for those who are not working experts on this technology of what we are doing in our. Now, what we are doing is we are using essentially this same equation, except that we replace the mass term, which is popular, which is k squared, okay, by something which effectively is a momentum-dependent mass term, so a function rk of momentum. So I'll plot you some of these functions, okay? So this is a function given in units of k squared, so Kalman-Simonsky would mean constant. What we do is we use a momentum cutoff, which kind of, well, it's exponentially drops off a large momentum, and thereby has the advantage of making this entire functional differential equation for the effective action well-defined. So there's no additional regularization required, right? As soon as we impose the flow being driven by momentum dependent mass term, the flow equation itself is well-defined. And this is something we consider as beneficial. So now there's an entire conceptual theory behind it on how now to use this equation. Maybe I should not run into too much of the detail by discussing this. There's one point, though, which is important, which is because we will be studying theories which have non-trivial symmetry properties underlying to it. So we have to make sure, obviously, that when you use this type of technology, that symmetry principles are respected. And if not so, you would have to control them by imposing so-called modified Bohr identities, which do help to ensure that in the physical limit, following this type of flow, so the physical limit where you ultimately really remove the infrared cut k, right, your physical Green's functions all obey the required Bohr identities underlying to your theory. Now, as I said, this is something which has been very well tested in scalar theories and actually also in QCD. Now, for our type of business, the important step forward has been made a couple of years back by Martin Reutner, who decided, well, if it works so nicely for QCD, actually, it should also work for gravity. So the name of the game now is to try to understand the physics carried by a renormalization group flow for a gravitational field, and to ask the question of whether this type of flow, right, can give us an indication as to whether there exists an object like gamma star at the high energy limit, which could be used to formally define a microscopic action, so a starting point for a Wilsonian integrating of momentum also. Now, if one is playing around with the limits like that, on a technical level, what it means is you write down an ansatz for your effective action, and your effective action now would have to obey this type of functional differential effect. So the name of the game is then try to make an ansatz which hopefully captures the relevant physics. And I mean, these type of ansätze have been tested now with an increasing level of sophistication. I've written down only a few leading terms here, right? Something like, say, a running Newtonian coupling constant, a running cosmological constant, possible meta interaction, gauge friction, ghost terms, and whatnot. Now, once you have an ansatz, you would want to know how the couplings individually run. So you have couplings in here, in here, in here. So the thing to do is to put the ansatz into the right hand side and to project the right hand side onto the corresponding coefficient on the left hand side. Then you identify term by term the flow equation for the corresponding quantities. Now, there are some technicalities behind it. I won't run into that in much more detail, but as you can perhaps already see from here, there's a vast freedom in choosing the regulator function, RK, which means that, you know, I mean, in a way, Wilson doesn't care of how in detail you cut off your momenta, as long as you cut them off some way, and afterwards integrate over all momenta in order to reconstitute the full path integral. Okay, so the details on how you really do this cutting off shouldn't be too significant. So you can use this in order to construct, make sure, I mean, in a constructive way, that given the physical question you're raising, you like to adapt the regulator, ideally, to the physics question you're asking. So this is what is hidden in the word optimization. You really try to maximize the physics content in a given approximation for your effective action. Then the next step would be, okay, let's extend that approximation, check whether results are stable, and I mean, we've seen in many talks on this conference that this type of pattern does persist for the results obtained so far. Good. Let me now, for 2 minutes, discuss one of the features of this flow equation, and one of the features where in earlier studies in QCD, we have learned a lot of tricks as to how to deal with the symmetry properties of this equation. And where I'd like to make the suggestion kind of that all these technologies, in a way, are available and could be used and deployed in the context of quantum gravity as well. Now, this is transparency which I produced some time ago for a QCD conference, mm-hmm. and which summarize our, say, conceptual understanding on how to implement a flow in QCD. Okay, trying to capture the salient physics of, say, confinement and the infrared properties of QCD. Now, as you have seen, there are, in essence, 2-3 ways for doing that. So you make the first choice by deciding, do I want to use gauge variant variables in order to parameterize my flow, or do I want to use gauge invariant variables? Okay, so that's choice number one. Now let's look into the gauge variant choices. What can you do there? The first option is, okay, let me use a background field method. I mean, you've heard about that in this conference, and I mean, why are you using the background field formulas? And the background field formulas is extraordinarily useful because it helps you to construct a gauge invariant effective action function by means of the background field method. But then the price to pay for it is that you have this additional background field, and you have to make sure, right, that you control the background field dependence thereof. So there's a lot of work which has been going on along this line, and I mean important results QCD have been obtained along that web path. Alternative option is to say, I don't want to have the background here. I leave it out. I study a great gluon degrees of freedom, and I'm willing to pay the price of having to control, say, modified water identities along the flow in order to make sure that I capture the correct red physics. Okay? So that's the path you can follow, which has been followed in QCD, and I mean, good. Yes? Then it depends on how you fix the gauge, so you may use covariant or XL type gauges. I mean, this is technical differences in some of the cases. I mean, XL gauges certainly have the advantage that you get rid of the Gribov problem, which has been mentioned at this meeting. Okay, so in gravity, most of the studies so far use the sophisticated technology of background field flows. Okay, now if one would be aiming at gauge invariant flows, the task first and foremost would be to either introduce gauge covariant variables, such as perhaps the analog of Wilson rules, or to introduce geometrical flows. Which also have been mentioned. I mean, these are, for example, the Wilkowitz-Witt type approaches to standard, in these dimensions. Now, the nice thing here is that the geometrical flows have an intimate link to the standard background field flows because they fall back onto the latter once one linearizes the connection variable. Good. Now, this is roughly the picture which has emerged from using this RG flow technology in QCD and the type of approaches and results which have been achieved in that direction. Now, for gravity, it would be interesting to try to explore this freedom to some extent, in particular because we like to understand and make sure that the results which we are finding do not depend on the way we implement our degrees of freedom. Now I'd like to come to a different topic and show you results of a recent computation, which partly also precisely addresses the topics that we're on a formal level right now. This is Young Mills coupled to gravity. Okay, that's a topic actually where we had a nice review yesterday by Gianpaolo Macca. It's a topic which has seen a lot of renewed interest lately. Sparked off by a paper by Wilson and Robinson a couple of years ago, where they looked into the one-loop beta function, named out more precisely the question of how would the beta function of Young-Mills theory be modified if we allow gravity to couple back into that setup. Yes? And in a way, this is probably the type of question where also some of what I just said can be elucidated in an explicit computation. Now, we've been doing two types of computations. The first computation is by using the standard background field flow based on the following ansatz. Now, forget these technicalities for the time being. The ansatz is we take Einstein-Hilbert, we take Young-Mills, and we allow for a running wave function renormalization for a wave, the graviton, and corresponding for the gauge couple. Now we make our choices. Our choice, how we introduce the regulator, is this. This is our regulator function. Phi is now the background field, so it means both graviton, Young-Mills, whatever goes. Okay? And we choose a regulator which is proportional to gamma 2 itself, times some dimensionless function r. And the dimensionless function r, now obviously this is a matrix, so these are two matrices which are being multiplied here, but the matrix little r, we choose diagonal to make sure that we don't have a mixing between, an artificial mixing between graviton and ghost, right, because there's no physics reason for us to introduce that by hand. Now if we do that, the flow equation looks like this. It's a straightforward analysis, okay? So what one deduces from this equation is that to one loop order, there's strictly no contribution from the graviton to the Young-Mills beta function. This comes about because on the one loop order, it's only the first term which does contribute. But the first term is diagonal because little r has been chosen to be diagonal. Choose little r to be diagonal because we don't see any reason for why the regulator to construct our RG flow should mix gravitons with gluons. The second term here, the second term in general will mix. In the other one loop, we will expect that mixing terms will mix. Now, that's how it is. Okay? So based on this analysis, the conclusion would be there's no graviton contribution to our mean. Now, that's not the end of the story, because here we've been using the background field method, which means that at an intermediate step in the computation, we have identified the background field with the expectation value of the physical mean field. So we have to make sure that there's no background field dependence in our one loop result. Okay? Now, how we check that? We look into the equation for the background field dependence, which is this one. Okay? So this is like asking, how does the effective action gamma of phi and phi bar, so the propagating and the background field, depend on the background field? Okay? Now, this is a non-trivial equation. Now, an analysis of the background field dependence has been done in Young-Mills theory some time ago. Okay? And so you see, I mean, it's a tiny bit funny, because in Young-Mills theory, you would think on one loop, what could possibly go wrong? You compute the one loop beta function, yes? On one loop, there's no physical scale present, okay? So you only have to project on one specific logarithmic divergency, which is a specific heap kernel coefficient, and in essence, no matter what you do, you should get the right result, okay? Point here is, no, this is not necessarily true if you introduce a regularization which has potential singularity. Now, we have checked and analyzed that in all detail for Young-Mills in this setup on the one-loop level to explicitly compute these contributions and to show that you may have a contribution coming from the background field. Those can be identified and taken into account, so you do understand what is going on, and you then obviously get the correct one-loop result out of this study. Now, here, the situation is even a bit more tricky. Because here, we're talking also about gravity. Now, the gravitational coupling already at the one-loop level does introduce an additional scale. Okay? So in the Young-Mills situation, the additional scale implicitly sneaked in because we can choose singular, infrared singular regulators, if we so wish, like a sharp cutoff. Okay? But effectively, this does introduce a new scale, which reflects on the one-loop level for the beta function. But in gravity, we already have a scale which is set by the gravitational coupling itself. So one would have to take background field dependencies carefully. Good. So if you analyze the same equation, what you get is this equation translated for our regulator is this. This term is diagonal, no contribution from that. This operator is diagonal, nothing from this. But this guy here can have a contribution on the one loop level. So, what to do with it? Analyzing this equation is a bit tricky. So, we decided just to do the opposite computation. Okay? So, in order to check it, we redid the entire computation on flat background. Okay? In order to identify the correct Young-Mills beta function. So what we here have to do is to compute every gluon, fat bone, and I mean, okay, so this will be the right-hand side of your flow equation now for the gluon two-point function. Okay, so that's the right-hand side of your flow equation from which you then deduce the beta function. So you have to perform a couple of integrations here. I won't give you the technicalities, but I mean, okay, good. As it involves subtracting and integrating a couple of propagators. So the result of that computation is here. One loop order, you get a coefficient times. Now I write it in the notation which Wilczek introduced. I replaced k by energy E. Okay, so but perhaps better think of k here now. Yes. So you see, there is in general a non-trivial coefficient. I mean, it's perhaps not completely unexpected because it's a non-universal coefficient anyway. But we understand. I think we do understand pretty well this coefficient now. It is an integral over the graviton regularization function and the gluon regularization function, and it does depend on the gluon gauge fixing, but not on the graviton gauge fixing. The global property of this coefficient is the coefficient is either positive or zero. So there are infinitely many classes of regularizations where this one loop coefficient actually is zero. But it cannot have the opposite sign. So actually, the sign is the sign which would support asymptotic freedom in the Young-Wild set. So this also fits into the many computations which came out after Wilczek and Robinson, which use various gauges and various regularizations. Yes, and all of these results can be understood now in terms of this expression, which clearly shows you the gauge fixing dependence and the regularization dependence, yes, and the overall property that either the coefficient is positive or actually it is zero. Now, beyond one loop, you can go further, study this theory, and you can see that indeed we can show that asymptotic freedom persists even in the presence of a gravitational fixed point, which for the one loop computation we did not assume. Now, obviously, the interesting question is what happens the other way around. Okay, so we now only fuel gravity back into the Young-Wild set. Okay? But then the interesting question is what happens if we fuel Young-Wild back into the gravitational set? So here are the diagrams which you would have to compute in order to solve the flow equation for that. So that's the flow for the graviton propagator now, which gets Young-Wild's insertions, okay, so the one factor 1/2 minus and plus this thing, okay? Now, if you do that, okay, I can show you how the right-hand side of the flow for the graviton two-point function looks like. So the right-hand side is this, okay, which in our approximation, Einstein-Hilbert, yes, is where this essentially is approximated by the cosmological constant, or a constant term, plus something which is proportional to momentum squared. Okay, and the coefficient proportional to momentum squared is what would be then the contribution to the running of the gravitational factor. Okay? And now you immediately see that the right-hand side is kind of tricky. Right-hand side is tricky because you now have to make the choice and I find out whether this contribution is actually a contribution to the running of the cosmological constant, which would be the constant term, and the corresponding coefficient would contribute to the cosmological constant, or whether this is a contribution to the running of the gravitational coupling. Okay, so the curvature, the derivative with respect to momentum squared, okay, that coefficient gives you the contribution to the running of the gravitational coupling. Now, if you project on the curvature, you immediately see that, oops, the curvature is negative sign here, a positive sign here. Okay? So if one would naively do, say, a derivative expansion about vanishing field, you get one sign here for the curvature contribution and the other sign there. Now, because the entire variation is only 6% of its absolute value, okay, what we did is we've been reading that contribution as a contribution to the cosmological constant, because it is, in essence, constant up to a variation of 6%. Good. If you do this, you can then splice this back into the coupled system of Young-Wild and gravity and find the joint fixed point of that entire system. Okay, and this should be 2 times lambda, and this is gravitational coupling divided by the gravitational coupling in the absence of Young-Wild's field. Yeah, so you see that that the UV fixed point nicely persists if you fully couple Young-Wild's gravity back into the system. Good. So this is an example where I tried to kind of highlight a bit the importance of understanding background field dependencies and really trying to understand which terms are fueling the RG flow in such a setup. Okay. Now, for the last 10-15 minutes, I'd like to come to a different topic. Now, we'll leave this aside for a minute and really look into different type of physics questions. Okay. I'd like to look a bit more into the potential for phenomenological signatures of asymptotic safety type scenarios. Now, we already had a couple of suggestions, and I mean, but this has been mentioned by other speakers, such as looking into fingerprints of asymptotic safety in the physics of the early universe, and in particular in cosmology. Yes, we had a very nice talk also about the physics of black holes in this context, so I won't run into this. I'd like to open a different door, which has to do with a possibly crazy idea, but which has received a lot of attention in the particle phenomenology community, which is the idea of having a low-scale quantum gravity collider. Now, what would that mean? Yes? It's like, I mean, one of the, okay, and also this has already fortunately been discussed at this meeting. I mean, in the standard model, we do have this pseudo problem of this large hierarchy between the electroweak scale and the fundamental scale of quantum gravity. Now, if for whatever reason it would turn out to be that the fundamental Planck scale is not of the order of 10 to the 19 GeV, but rather of the order of 1 TeV, right, that would be extremely interesting from a particle physics point of view, because the hierarchy problem of the standard model would naturally be absent. Now, this is an idea which has seen a lot of activity in the past, well, 12 years perhaps, and a number of particle physics scenarios have been generated suggesting mechanisms for how that can be achieved. And I'd like to, well, you know all of that, I guess. I'd like to focus on a specific scenario, although for most what I'd be saying, actually the implications will also fold for other scenarios as well, but to be explicit, I will use this one. It's the so-called large extra dimension scenario introduced by Tanya Hamid, Dimopoulos, and Mali, something like that. Based on the assumption that if our standard model particles were to be living on a four-dimensional frame, but gravity actually lives in some higher-dimensional space-time, thereby allowing gravity to propagate in further dimensions, whereas standard model particles are not allowed to do that, this could be a mechanism to kind of explain why the gravitational force looks so weak when we measure it in the laboratory, but in fact it is much stronger because we just don't see that it gets diluted into the extra dimensions. And so this is the physics motivation. Now, why is this of interest for an asymptotic safety scenario? It is of interest simply also because, you know, we do see by now we have non-trivial and highly fascinating indications for a fixed point in four dimensions. But I mean, what is special about four in the context of gravity? Four for gravity, in a renormalization group point of view, for sure, is nothing special at all. Virulent quantum fluctuations driving a renormalization group equation for gravity in four dimensions. Right? You have them in five dimensions, okay, you have them in six dimensions, but now, if you say stand up and say, well, I have an argument and I have a computation which sees this fixed point in four dimensions, right, you would wonder what happens to that fixed point if you change dimensionality to 5 or 6. Now, in a way, perhaps, I mean, if you think of dimensionality, I mean, what is special about 4, right? I mean, you could say that in two dimensions, gravity is not really dynamical. The next integer dimension is 3, but there again, it's not yet fully dynamical, but the theory already gets some structure, namely having black hole solutions, some trivial ones, whereas 4 is perhaps the first integer dimension where a fully dynamical gravity theory can live. Right. So at any rate, if you have a fixed point in 4 dimensions, you would kind of have the suspicion that the fixed point should survive in higher dimensions. Now, this is a work I did some time ago together with Lisa Fischer, where we actually accessed that. So we did study in various, Heinstein-Hilbert theory, but using a variety of cutoffs in order to be sure that the physical content of that fixed point is independent of the way we regularize the theory. I mean, you see, we have checked a variety of classes of cutoffs, and you see the scaling exponents are very stable. So this was, for us, enough motivation to say, OK, let's try to use this fixed point and do some phenomenology with it. Okay? So we now turn the point of view, and I mean, we now take the other point of view and say, good, right? Let's read this as an effective action where the gravitational coupling does indeed run in a non-trivial way according to some renormalization group equations, and ask whether this could potentially be detectable in physics observables. Now, this is a brief sketch on how the RG running would look like. This is how it comes out if you numerically integrate these equations for various extra dimensions. So n is now counting the number of extra spatial dimensions in this setup. So now with this in hand, you'd like to sit down and say, good, OK, there are these people saying we may have low-scale quantum gravity at the LHC. So if this is so, gravity would have to leave a fingerprint in physics observables, right? And in particular, one would have to have some type of theory in order to be able to describe these type of observables. But first and foremost, you would have to ask the question, what are the observables we can reasonably hope to access? Now, people have identified 3. First of them is real graviton emissions. Obviously, if the TV scale right is a quantum gravity scale, you would expect the emission, thank you very much, gravitons. The second is fingerprints because of virtual graviton processes. So one of the very important candles for standard model physics, right, is Drell-Young lepton production. This is a process which in standard model physics is very well understood. But if now gravity is strong at 1 TeV, gravitons will contribute to that process as well. So you would see deviations from standard model processes. And the third one, of course, I mean, everybody has heard about that one, is the possible production of black holes and their possibly spectacular decay into whatever many-body final states. Good. So let me highlight 3 applications of this idea. Okay, the first one is the effect of virtual gravitons on Drell-Young lepton production. Now, the theory goes like this. I mean, you write down effective scattering amplitude, and in effective theory, I mean, it is essentially given by this expression. Now, in effective theory, what you use is you use the perturbative graviton propagator in your computation. But then you realize that your expressions are ultraviolet divergent, so you would have to impose an ultraviolet cutoff. That you know from the onset, because an effective theory approach, as we know, is reliable as long as the energy scales you probe are sufficiently below the actual time scale. Now, if you do that, and here I'm citing the work of these people, if you do that, you can nevertheless, I mean, now you have an effective amplitude, you can splice it into a Monte Carlo simulation and ask whether I would be sensitive, yes, to, on the 5 sigma level, to the underlying Planck scale by looking for deviations of Drell-Young production compared to the normal standard model Drell-Young production. Okay? So that's the plot which has a 5 sigma deviation in this production cost. Now, what you see is this is plotted as a function of the by hand introduced ultraviolet cutoff in this effective theory computation. And you see, however, that if you try to remove the cutoff for too many extra dimensions, it will simply not work, because the underlying production amplitude is ultraviolet divergence. So you're not getting rid of that. And therefore, you will not be able to make a sensible statement about sensitivity for the underlying Planck state. Now you do the very same business with the renormalization group improved production mechanism, where we take into account that the graviton does acquire an energy-dependent non-trivial anomalous dimension. Now if you do this, and you make the same type of analysis introduced by hand and ultraviolet cutoff in your production cross-section and then remove it, you see that the plots all settle down simply because the underlying production cross-section is no longer ultraviolet divergent. So this is the fingerprint of fixed point behavior, because the fixed point scaling suppresses sufficiently strong all the extra Kaluza-Klein type contributions to this production cross-section. Good. So that's observer number one. Observer number two is to do with the speculation that black holes may be created in high energy particle collisions. Now that's an idea first brought up by these people, and it is based on a semi-classical picture for what a black hole is. Namely, you write down its line element, you know what its classical Schwarzschild radius is, and the expectation is that the leading order, the production cross-section for a black hole to be formed in a particle collision with center of mass energy square root of s, is to first approximation just given by the geometrical cross-section, pi r classical square, possibly modified by some form factor which takes into account that inefficiencies in the production mechanisms, and possibly phenomenologically theta function, which tells us that perhaps if the center of mass energy is not large enough, we may not have a black hole after all. Now, that's the semi-classical picture, which is still in use these days and used for actual simulations of Atlas events at the LHC. Now,
and which has been this idea extremely popular.
Yes, that's right. The press. Well, indeed. So, what we've been doing is we've been taking up an idea which has emerged earlier in the four-dimensional case, in order to incorporate the renormalization group running of the gravitational coupling, and to ask the question, what will happen with the production cross-section if quantum corrections are taken into account? Now, so the central change which will take place is the gravitational coupling will become a running coupling, d of r. And the central physics, which will later on play a role, is only the fact that g of r actually gets weaker. Okay. So the conclusions, which I will take later on, I mean, entirely based on G becoming weaker. Now, the fixed point scenario, in a way, suggests that, indeed, dimension for G of R is getting weaker in a very specified way. Yes. So it does clearly belong into the class of these models. Good. Now, if this is going to happen, we just do our straightforward your analysis to identify the improved Schwarzschild radius. The main driving force in this work actually is Kevin Foss, who is in the audience and would certainly be happy to give you a detailed discussion of also, I mean, many more results, which I have not the time to show you. But broadly speaking, the result will be this. You have the classical curve, which I didn't display, but then independent of actually the mass of the black hole, the corresponding Schwarzschild radius will start decreasing. Now, this is an effect which does depend on the size and the mass of the Schwarzschild black hole, and even more so, and that's the most important effect here, it will go down, but then there is something like Well, I would call it the smallest black hole, because if you go for below a critical mass in C, at least this RG improved Schwarzschild spacetime will no longer displace or display your horizon. Okay, now you can sit down and do this analysis for various dimensions. So this is the result for 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 dimensions. So you see that, okay, for large mass, radius is roughly given by the Schwarzschild radius. Now you decrease mass up to critical mass, you see the Schwarzschild radius will decrease. Good. Now, what does that mean for black hole production at the LHC? Okay, so what you have to answer that question is just splice now the RG improved production cross section into into the formula for elastic black hole production at the LHC. We've been using these parton distribution functions to do that, and the result is given here. So what you see, the black curve, so this is n equals 4 x dimension, so the black curve is the classical result. Okay. So for sufficiently, so say, let's look at this example here. So what I have varied is just the critical mass mc. Okay, so let's assume that the critical mass is of the order of twice 2 TeV. So then you see that once you approach really the interesting regime of Planck scale physics, the production cross section goes clearly down. Well, this is perhaps a factor of, I don't know, 2, something like that, possibly a bit more. Yes. So the overall effect of this analysis is that the likelihood for seeing black holes, I mean, is kind of reduced by a form factor originating from the renormalization group running of the gravitational coupling once you approach within an effective theory setting the physics of the Planck scale. Okay, so now the last thing I want to say is that, you see, I mean, now we are playing the game trying to read a non-trivial renormalization group running of these couplings and their modifications of, for example, anomalous dimensions of propagators and such, and vertices, okay, in terms of an effective action gamma t literally. Now, you may wonder up to what energy scale such a description is possibly valid. And a good testing ground for this type of question is are unitarity bounds, which we know can be hit within effective theory approach. Now, this type of question in standard effective theory has been addressed by Hay some time ago. So he asked the question, if I have Higgs-Higgs elastic scattering, and I'm in an extra-dimensional scenario, okay, where additional Kaluza-Klein modes are propagating, right? Can I learn something about the domain of validity of this effective theory description? And then one way of doing it is that you say, yes, of course, I mean, because, you know, I will get additional contributions to Higgs-Higgs scattering. There's a bound on unitarity, at least perturbative unitarity, and then if once this is violated, obviously, I mean, you're in deep trouble, so you want to kind of stay away from it. Now, if you properly look into the standard effective theory cell, you will see you cannot push it very far, because end of story is already, end of line is already reached at the cutoff scale, which in this case is the Planck scale. Yeah? Now, what we've been doing is we replayed this game, but now taking the RG modifications into account, and ask the very same question. Now, this is just a kind of textbook know-how on how to translate the elastic scattering amplitude into a partial wave analysis. And the object to look at is this leading order coefficient A0, which by the unitarity, by the optical theorem, has to be bounded by 1. Now, if you do this study, you find this. You find that, this is actually a computation done by Jens Brinkmann, together with Gudrun Hiller from Dortmund, myself. So, what you see is three curves. Let's first look at this one. This is the curve where Planck scale has been set to 1 TeV. Okay, the scale at which the running of the gravitational coupling crosses over from perturbative to non-trivial UV fixed point scale, in this case is set to 1, okay, which is the natural thing to do, and we have set the number of extra dimensions to 2 and the mass of the Higgs field to 0 for simplicity, but I mean, you can also study it for vanishing, non-vanishing Higgs masses. So, remember, standard effective theory tells you it already breaks down here. Okay, you don't even have at 1, right? But here you see that because of the fixed point scaling and the suppression of the graviton propagator contributing to this amplitude A0, the breakdown is delayed. It does ultimately break down. This perturbative amplitude will break down, but it will break down later. Okay? That's a core kind of result of this study. Now, look into the other two curves. You see, I mean, if I put the crossover scale to a larger value, it would mean that the prism gravitational coupling will behave classically up to much, much higher energy. So this is precisely the limit where you think, okay, if you know, if I send that scale to infinity, I will never reach run into the fixed point, and everything will always stay classic. So in this limit, you would expect to fall back into the effective theory type of result. And indeed, this is what you see. This is given by the green curve here. Yes, and if you push this even further, I mean, this will just go, okay, bend towards 1 and tell you what you already knew, kind of. Last comment is this funny curve here, which happens to come out if you push it to, if you let the crossover happen too early, okay? So then actually you run into a scenario where you never satisfy the perturbative unitarity constraint. Good. So I think I'm probably through with my time. Thank you. So I should come to a few conclusions. Now, I think, I mean, okay, this is the 30 years of asymptotic safety conference, yes. I still think it's an absolutely fascinating idea, just like the possibility of understanding gravity, right, in the same ballpark of techniques such as local quantum field theory, as we do understand all the other forces, I think it's absolutely fascinating and worth of being exploited. Now, what I see at this meeting is that there are by now many different and interesting scenarios, even beyond gravity, where actually this type of idea can be realized. Yes? I mean, the important message in my eyes is that many highly non-trivial tools are available in order to ask precise questions. This is based on new ideas within perturbation theory, renormalization group methods, which I highlighted today, yes, and very interesting technology available on the lattice, right? Now, given the fact that you see, I mean, think back, if you think of what I said initially, I mean, you see, I mean, we are, in a way, we are doing the upside, the bottom-up Wilson-type look at gravity, okay? So the normal reasoning is just the other way around. And why is the other way around nice? Because the other way around is nice because universality will help you so much in understanding what, at a critical point, will be the relevant operators in the low-energy regime of that theory. Okay? Now, this is something which helps you so much, but which is so much in your way now that you try to understand what is possibly going on in the high-energy limit. Okay? Now, so is there something we can do about it? I fear not, at least not for the time being, unless we have a deep structural insights into what the theory up there actually should look like. So the best thing for the time being probably to do is to try and use all available tools to look into this theory and try to unfold the non-trivial high-energy content thereof. Now, I took the job to look into spires, yes, and I typed in, I think, I don't know, keywords asymptotic safety and perhaps fixed point gravity or so, just to see which type of activity level we have seen, this field has seen in the couple in the last decade. And I mean, one really sees here that, okay, so although the idea is quite old, but it's only in the past perhaps decade that increased activity has set in. I mean, I guess I have roughly missed half of the papers with this plot, so this, the integral over this plot is, I think, 50. Yes, but I mean, there should be 100, maybe slightly more papers dealing specifically with this approach. Good. So the last point I'd like to stress is the potential for phenomenology. Right? On one side, I mean, we have seen that there are computational techniques on the market, and clearly there are a number of open questions which still need to be settled. Right? But then at the same time, there is a potential to do some interesting phenomenology in this context. And now, the last one obviously is, and that has been raised by a number of other speakers as well, is perhaps the hope of trying to understand, and I mean even more on a conceptual level, to see how these findings link with findings in neighboring fields, which however use similar conceptual ideas in order to access the physics of gravity at high energy. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this bright prospects. Are there some more questions?